Chevy Equinox with forward collision alert, automatic emergency braking, and available all-wheel drive. It's my ultimate mobile device. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule a test drive. Chevy Equinox. It's your choice. Own it.
It's 11 minutes after 12. Steve Bertrand here on a Thursday edition of the Wintrust Business Lunch. Dennis Rodkin is on a phone line. We're going to talk about housing a little bit, and then later we're going to talk to Steve Goldstein from MarketWatch.com. Now, Steve has written a column this week comparing the manufacturing numbers to the housing numbers. How is it that the housing can look so good and manufacturing so bad, and which one should we pay attention to? So that's coming up later in the program. Before that, it's going to be almost all housing, and Dennis Rodkin from Crane Chicago Business is on a phone line, and I just started laughing with Another One Bites the Dust. I'm trying to figure out some sort of a housing tie-in there, Dennis, but
I don't have one. I was wondering myself.
So far, I got nothing. Maybe it'll come to me a little bit later. How are you?
I'm great. How are you, Steve?
Yeah, good. So, you know, we're always talking about the numbers, and I'm interested. I go to I have a good friend who's in the steel industry, and he's always talking about how, you know, what dire straits we're in when it comes to manufacturing. And then I've said, well, look at the housing numbers, look at the jobless numbers. You know, things are really looking good there. So I'm looking forward to talking to Goldstein later in the program about, I think the headline on his story is the yin and yang of the economy. So we'll weigh those out. But right now, let's talk housing. And I know you've got a story up today about, you can read them at chicagobusiness.com. I don't say that enough for you, Dennis, but
thanks, Steve.
About the fact that it looks like Chicagoans took out, were they ahead of the national average when it comes to borrowing in the fourth quarter last year?
Considerably ahead, yeah. When it comes to purchase mortgages, Chicago was up about 2% in the last quarter of the year, while the rest of the country fell. While nationwide, the number of mortgages that came out, that were taken out for purchase of a house was down 1% from a year before. So fourth quarter 15 from fourth quarter 14. So we saw a rise, not a surge, but a rise in the number of purchase mortgages while the nation was falling. And then when it comes to refinancing, we were up, our increase was twice the national increase. There were about 2% more refinance mortgages taken out nationally, and we took out about 4.8% more. You know, we've talked about this. Chicago has been running a couple years behind most major cities' recoveries.
Right.
So what I would like to be able to do is look back about 2 years and find out if everybody else in the last quarter of 13 was doing what we did in the last quarter of 15.
All right, take a minute. Go ahead and look. We'll wait. Go ahead, Dennis.
Type. Yeah, I can't find it yet.
The question, though, then is because we've really lacked when it comes to prices, right? We've lagged behind the country. And so will this lead to, it looks like if there's a lot of activity when it comes to mortgages, there must be more competition for buying homes, and perhaps that will lead to higher prices.
Yes, that does appear. On Tuesday, we're going to get the end of the year Case-Shiller data, which will give us an idea not only how we performed for the month of December, but for all of 15 compared to other cities. And for a long time, we have been, marching to the beat of our own drummer.
Right.
Most cities go up and we go down, or most cities go up a lot, we go up only a little. So we'll see how we did for the year overall. It does look as if we started to sag a little toward the end of the year. We always do. The question is, and there aren't good numbers yet, did we sag more at the end of 15 than we usually do? And I don't think that's going to be the case. This is my estimate. We don't know until the data comes out. But I think we're going to find that our seasonal sag was a little bit lighter than it has been in the past few years, which is not to say we had a seasonal run-up, but just that we didn't sag quite as much.
We'll hope
for
that.
That's what I'm guessing, and we'll see what happens when the numbers come out.
All right, we'll watch for that. And that's next week, you say, correct?
Yeah, it comes out on Tuesday.
You've got so much to talk about today. I don't know where to go next. Let's go to Kenilworth, because you've got a great story on chicagobusiness.com about this family that keeps buying these old homes in Kenilworth to restore them or to rent them out. And basically, it's like a pet rescue. It's a housing rescue in Kenilworth.
It's like a pet rescue. Steve, I wish you had written the story. That's a great lead. This is interesting. These are people who have lived in Kenilworth for a very long time. Teardowns were quite controversial in Kenilworth really about 10 years ago. During the last boom, there was a lot of old housing being torn down and new houses built in their place. There were many solutions proposed, including landmarking the entire town, and all those things didn't really work out because you've got to balance the needs of people who want new houses against people who cherish old houses.
Right, and these old houses, the old houses aren't just drafty. I mean, they don't have, like you would expect, a family room or downstairs bathrooms. Right. I mean, they're old houses.
These were houses built for rich people at the early part of the 20th century, but even so, they have, like, no master bath, you know. Even wealthy people in the early 20th century didn't have a master suite. Imagine that. So what these people have done is they've found a way. They're sort of balancing both sides. They're buying up these houses, these historical houses, many of which would be demolished, many of which are in pretty bad condition when they get them, long-time owners, not a lot of maintenance. And then they try to restore them in such a way that they put in something like family room, master suite, that sort of thing, but keep the historical character of the house. They've got about $8 million in Kenilworth houses at this point. That's $8 million in purchase price, and as I said, they're buying them in bad shape.
And they're not buying them to turn around and make money. I mean, maybe that'll happen, right? But this is sort of a preservation effort.
Yeah, I think the goal, it is sort of a market-based approach because they have one on the market now, two more on the way. They have a total of eight houses, and the question will be what all sells and at what prices. So they do want to turn a profit in part as a model for other people. Look, you can go in and fix up these houses. It's not like anybody's surprised. You can fix up a house.
One more quick one before the break. Let's go to Ravenswood. Yeah. And this guy, Wallace Abbott, who is a pretty familiar name if you know Abbott Laboratories, obviously. But the house that he originally built in 1891 for sale in Ravenswood. Tell me about that.
Well, it's kind of cool. There are two interesting things about it. He built it. It's right by the Ravenswood metro stop. His factory was right by the Ravenswood metro stop, and he built his house right there, a block away. And then when he moved his factory not too much later, all the way north up the same train line to North Chicago, he still lived in the house. So, you know, it worked out real well. He could get back and forth by train. And the other kind of cool thing about it is Abbott Labs, about 20 years ago, bought the house. It had been a funeral home. They bought it in order to clone it. There is a duplicate of the house at the Abbott Labs campus up by Waukegan, which is sort of a museum of the history of Abbott. And then once they had done their thing and they took a few things out of it, like a curbstone with Abbott's name on it and stuff, then they put it back on the open market, and it's been a home ever since. Just got a green updating, has solar panels and things like that. But otherwise, really looks just like it did when he built it.
That's Dennis Rodkin writing for Crane Chicago Business. We're going to take a break, Dennis, and when we come back, we'll talk about Jed Clampett and Lance Briggs. How's that for a duo?
That's great.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Let's check the traffic hotspots.
Listen to my story about a man named Jed. A poor mountaineer barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food, and up to the ground come a bubbling crew.
It's 1223. You're listening to The Business Lunch and the Beverly Hillbillies here on 720 WGN. And Dennis Rodkin, too, from Crane Chicago Business. All right, Dennis, we're going to have to sort this one out. Tell me about...
I'm sorry, I'm just chuckling about the song.
Arnold Kirkby, did I pronounce that name correctly?
Yes, you did.
I love talking to you because I learned, we're talking about current housing, but so much history too. So Arnold Kirkby, Chicago-born hotelier, he owned at one time the Blackstone Hotel, operated the Drake Hotel, operated hotels in Manhattan, Beverly Hills, Cuba, Panama. He lived in Wicker Park. His home is for sale, but we all know his California house, right?
Exactly. He grew up on Caton Street in Wicker Park. That house is for sale. When he grew up and had this big, fabulous hotel chain, and also, by the way, had a wife who was a Cuban cigar heiress, they bought a huge mansion in Bel Air that was featured in the Beverly Hillbillies. He's the guy who signed the contract to let them shoot at his house for $500 a day.
So Ellie Mae was in his cement pond.
I guess, yeah. As far as I can tell, there's no cement pond at the house. The cement pond was in the back lot or whatever, you know, where they produced the show. But when you see the Beverly Hillbillies driving up to the house anything filmed out front, that sort of thing. This was his house. So if you're walking down Caton Street and you see this nice, it doesn't look a thing like the Beverly Hills Hillbillies mansion, but it's a very nice house. You know that the guy who eventually rented out the Beverly Hillbillies mansion grew up there.
He signed the rental agreement in 1962 for $500 a day. Now, I would imagine they probably weren't shooting there all that often, right? They probably just did the exteriors and things like that. But $500 a day, that's not too bad.
It's not too bad. He died before the show went on the air. And you know, one thing I didn't have a chance to say, didn't have room to say in the story, is the mansion, while he lived there, was also featured in the movie Cinderfella by Jerry Lewis.
Well, there you go. I don't know which is a better claim to fame or worse claim to fame, Dennis. I'm not sure.
Or worse. Exactly.
Lance Briggs played for the Chicago Bears as a linebacker for several years, retired recently after the 2014 season, 12 years with the Bears. He had a deal to sell his townhouse in Northbrook and then apparently changed his mind or backed out, and now there's litigation. Explain that one for me.
You know, it's hard to – we can't sort it out completely because – no comment from him and very little comment from his adversary, but he had a townhouse in Northbrook that he bought before buying a considerable mansion next door in Northfield, and he had it on the market. Last summer, he had a deal to sell it at, or he signed a contract to sell it at a pretty big loss, and just before the closing, apparently he personally canceled the deal. And the potential buyer has recently sued because several months went by. Apparently, this jilted home buyer kept going back to Briggs and saying, you know, we need to close this deal, and was getting stonewalled.
Now, did
so
I read?
They had to sue.
Did I read in what you wrote that his earnest money is still being held?
Which is a little surprising. According to his lawsuit, Briggs still has his earnest money, even though he canceled the contract. There's no stipulation in the contract for keeping the seller keeping the earnest money if the seller cancels the contract.
Yeah, that'd be quite a deal. I'm going to sell my house.
Yeah, right, exactly. And you can cancel four or five contracts and take a nice vacation.
All right,
exactly.
So there's really no sort of resolution to this in sight, right? The transaction is still listed as pending, and they'll probably go to court and sort it out.
We assume they will. Now, again, nobody would comment. But what they're asking the judge to do is essentially force Briggs to close the contract or pay damages and return the earnest money.
Dennis,
and I'm assuming that this does go to court because there was no reply from Briggs' side.
Right. And if Briggs wins, again, my house is for sale. You can buy it if you'd like.
Exactly. Yeah. Everybody just line up and drop off your earnest money.
Why not? Dennis Rodkins writes for Chicago, Crane Chicago Business. You can read these at chicagobusiness.com. Dennis, great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us again today.
It's always fun, Steve. Thanks a lot.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's a Thursday afternoon, sitting along Michigan Avenue in the Allstate Showcase Studio, and I can see Chicago ready to throw off its winter coat. We might get 60 degrees tomorrow, around 40 today, so not too bad. All right, when you consider the economy, what number do you look at to figure out if we're doing okay? You know, I think we focus a lot on Wall Street. We give the stock market numbers every half hour on this radio station. A lot of people look at the unemployment rate. Some people saying we're at full employment now. Housing has been a good number, but it's not been so good for manufacturing. Stephen Goldstein has written about that for MarketWatch.com. He's calling it the yin and the yang of the economy, the housing numbers versus the manufacturing numbers. And he will join us in just a bit on the Business Lunch to talk about that. But first, we're going to say hello to Bridget Carey from CNET. Bridget, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I'm torn to talk to you about first the situation with Apple, or if we should just play around with some toys. And, you know, we talked a little bit on the program about Apple yesterday, but it's still getting a lot of buzz today. So maybe we should just kick that around a little bit. Have there been any new developments in this standoff between the federal prosecutors wanting to get an encryption code to Apple iPhones and Apple saying, no, we're just not going to do that?
I think what people are now talking about is becoming a political issue, obviously, as we all kind of expected it to be. And also, you're starting to hear some other tech CEOs kind of meekly step forward and support Apple, although not very strongly, because I don't think they want to deal with the battle themselves so much. The head of Google, Sundar Pichai, went to Twitter and did say that this can be a concern for all consumers when it comes to the security of their devices, but then didn't really stop short as to, like, you know, really rally the troops. So, you know, there's still a little silence over at Microsoft, but all these tech companies really have been fighting this battle behind the scenes for a long time now. I mean, the battle between law enforcement and how secure your devices are has been waging for a while, but this is such a high-profile case because of, A, it involves a terrorist, and also of how exactly the government is essentially ordering Apple to do this. It comes down to not just saying, hey, can you hand over the master key so we can look into the iPhone, or can you hand over the data that you have in your servers? This is saying, can you build software, extra software, to break into and undo all the security that you work hard to sell, and that and essentially when software is created, well, gosh, it's not just something you could say, oh, yeah, this is just for this one case. When there's software created, this can get anywhere. But, and that means you're not going, oh, well, I care about the privacy, or versus I care about, you know, fighting terrorism. It's once the hole is made, anyone can get in for the future for any product. And that's what people are afraid of, well, the future of what security means.
You're right, I know. But it's interesting because you said it's getting political, and this is one of those situations where I'm not sure how it breaks down on political lines. I'm in a podcast here at WGN called The Mincing Rascals, and it's a mixture of moderate, liberal, conservative people. And one of the conservative members of our group this today said, you know, she doesn't like it, not because she doesn't like the idea of Apple being forced to turn this over, based on personal privacy issues. So in many ways, that's a very conservative issue. Keep government out of our privacy. It's also conservative to really stress security. So, you know, this is one of those things that doesn't really fall across conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican lines, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, the reason they're fighting back is because the court is saying, can you make software to undo your security? And so does that mean that they, if they can the government at any point in time say, hey, Microsoft, hey, Google, can you write new code to essentially malware? Can you make malware and install it on computers? And then if that gets out, then it's not just about going, oh, we're fighting this one case of this one bad guy to investigate what they did on their phone or their computer. But you'd hate to think that, you know, when software gets out so easily, well, then, gosh, you know, you can make holes anywhere, and then why even bother having any security? So it's not like, oh, I don't care what the government sees about what I do, as some people argue, but it goes a little deeper than that.
All right, let's talk
about, like, well, what can hackers get in? Yeah.
Let's have more fun. Let's talk toys. I know the big toy show was just in New York.
something less depressing.
Right. Well, it's funny because maybe the toys that are so hot now are sort of these STEM toys that are the people who are either going to grow up to be the programmers for Apple, or they're going to be the people coming up with the malware against Apple. I don't know. But there's a real movement now toward this sort of STEM toy, particularly for girls, correct?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so give a little background. Every year in New York City, they have the Toy Fair, and I've been going for several years now to see the high-tech side of playtime. And when it comes to learning, yeah, you're seeing a lot more toys that incorporate how to program into you know, playtime. So you're not just, I mean, I've seen things for preschoolers where there's a caterpillar. There's no screen. There's no actual doing, you know, coding. It's more like the concept of coding. You know, if do this, then this happens. And that's being integrated more into just a physical toy that you can touch and watch it roll or watch it climb or grab something.
So kind of the logic of coding with these preschool toys.
Right, because if you make it about homework and sitting in front of a computer, you can do that for the older kids, and they do have those toys I saw too, you know, but at least make it a little more fun So it doesn't seem like homework for the younger generation. And I think another trend I've seen is that there, if you go back maybe 2 or 3 years ago, it felt like when you go to Mattel or you go to Hasbro, it was so obvious when they wanted to put tech in a toy. They just slapped, here, insert your parents' iPhone or your parents' iPad into this, and now it's a tech toy. And suddenly your kids play with a screen. Well, guess what? That didn't sell because parents didn't really want to keep putting more screens in front of their kids' faces. And now they're realizing, hey, you know what? You don't have to be so obvious about having a screen or even having data sent to the cloud and saving things for you to have high-tech fun. So I think one of the cool trends that really is new this year is 3D printing toys. And what I mean by that are these machines that have been for adults so far, that they print plastic shapes, but they're now safe enough for kids to use, depending on the age, unsupervised. There was even one that is the shape of a pen, and the same concept as a hot glue gun where the plastic melts and you can spit it out and shape it as you draw. But I could do it on my skin, and it didn't burn me. It was very safe in that sense, and it's $40. And you can make your own action figures then. You just, melt plastic. We used to melt, jellies for creepy crawler bugs. Or
remember the Shrinky Dinks?
Or Play-Doh.
I used to have Shrinky Dinks.
Yeah. Yes, Shrinky Dinks. So now it's a new type of way of making your own little creation instead of Play-Doh. It's like, melting plastic into something hard, and it can also be biodegradable and safe to eat. So I think it's cool that these concepts of making your own playtime and kind of learning a little bit in the process of what it takes to make a structure and turning into something that is safe for kids. So I think the hot toy is a toy that can make other toys.
And the idea, too, is that, this is good when it comes to putting the basics for coding or things like that into kids' minds, but it's also becoming a really super big market for these toy companies.
Right. It's a little bit of engineering thrown in there because you have to think about how to put things together. Mattel has this $300 printer that you can snap different shapes together to make something. But then, yeah, exactly. It becomes another opportunity to like take it up another step, too. And some of them, though, when it comes to high-tech toys, they're not all exactly, on the get smarter with your kids side. I mean, Barbie has a hoverboard now. Sometimes I think they're just throwing hoverboards.
Oh, no, we're going to confiscate that cover. That's not safe.
I should say, she calls it a hoverboard. To you and me, it's a drone. It's a quadcopter. So they're throwing quadcopters and flying things on everything now. So now you have more things for your kids to fly in the house and break the vase.
Perfect. So the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Exactly.
Bridget Carey writes for CNET. Bridget, thanks very much for joining us today in the Business Lunch. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks. It's been a pleasure.
We'll check the Wall Street numbers coming up next on 720 WGN. Thank you, Steve and Kim and Dolly, for all of that. Bill and Wendy coming up with the second half of their show just after the 1 o'clock news. I'm Steve Bertrand, and this is the Wintrust Business Lunch. I hope you'll follow me on Twitter at Steve Bertrand or on Facebook. Got a page at Steve Bertrand, also Steve Bertrand on books. All right, Steve Goldstein from MarketWatch.com has been on with us before, and he wrote a piece that grabbed my attention earlier this week. Manufacturing and housing are the yin and yang of the U.S. economy. That was the headline. Steve, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Good afternoon.
With me, and I bring this up all the time, and I know there's not one pure answer, but I'm always interested in to try to figure out how we're doing. And then, well, what do we look at to figure out how we are doing? Do we look at Wall Street? Do we look at jobless numbers, housing numbers? This week you write about manufacturing numbers. I mean, there probably isn't one gauge to sort of measure where the economy's headed.
Yeah, and that's one of the troubles about, well, first of all, for the market, trying to figure out, well, what numbers to pay attention to. And also for those of us who write about what the economy is doing, there are a lot of numbers out there. Traditionally, manufacturing is one of the good indicators, not just because it used to be of size, but, it's just more sensitive to economic developments than other industries.
Well, I have a good friend who's in the steel business, and every time I start to talk about how rosy things are looking, he rolls his eyes and says, you have no idea, which I think speaks to the manufacturing numbers. And it's what you write about. Housing's looking good. Manufacturing in this country, not so good.
No, it's not looking good. And, you know, you can't just put it at one broad brush, because part of manufacturing is the auto industry, which is still doing really terrific. But a lot of it is not. And they're coming up against a couple headwinds. One of the things that has really transformed the U.S. economy has been the shale oil revolution.
Okay.
You know, the ability to extract oil and gas from places we never imagined. And that business has been decimated as, you know, crude oil prices have tumbled. All that growth, all that new business, which, you know, affects companies down the line, not just the energy producers, but, you know, all the equipment that they need for that. And, you know, that sort of domino impact. So you had that great tailwind, and now that's completely gone. And you know, we read about oil companies in trouble every day. So they're cutting spending dramatically right now. So that's one of the one piece of bad news. And by the way, that oil industry doesn't just hurt us in the U.S., but also, you know, Canada is seeing some of those same problems and other major oil producers. The other thing that's going on is that the U.S. dollar has really appreciated, because the overall economy here is doing pretty good. And that of many of the other big economies around the world is not doing so good.
So you're right about that. So you say the manufacturing that has to do with trade is suffering more than what, the locally consumed manufacturing?
Yeah, that's right. So if you're, and again, this, you know, manufacturing, these are the things, it's much easier to ship a good overseas than it is a service for the most part. You know, film accepted, but basically, you know, when people are talking about exports, you export things, mm-hmm. Rather than services. And so the things economy, if we're going to boil it down, is doing not very good right now. And, you know, there's not much demand from overseas because U.S. products are comparatively expensive and because there isn't much growth over there. China has seen, even though it's growing quicker than we are, it's not growing nearly as fast as they were doing just even a couple years ago. And in Europe and in Japan, they're either growing very little or not at all. So there's not much demand out there overseas, and plus they, you know, often can get cheaper substitutes at home.
Okay, so what do we do about that? Is there something, is there a remedy, or is it something that we just have to wait out, or is it just something where we slough off jobs and profit and go elsewhere?
Well, I think what's really happening is the latter, that these are just jobs we're not going to have right now. Obviously, manufacturers are trying to compete. They're trying to either cut prices or, you know, they're shifting business. And again, it's not even all manufacturers. The ones that are more exposed to kind of what's going on here in the U.S., you know, that are making products to use in housing, for instance, they are doing better. That, you know, this is just part of the global economy. And, you know, sometimes you're going to have some sectors that are better than others. And I think what investors are finding is that they're going to have to make those shifts as well. And it's really the, you know, the companies that we read about on the stock market most days are these heavily multinational companies. And so it's not a surprise that they're doing really poorly right now. You know, they have sending their products to 50 countries or 100 companies, that kind of company is not going to do as well. And maybe the local company that, you know, shifts to three states instead, they're having a better time of it, but they may not be listed on the stock market.
That's Steve Goldstein. Steve, we got to run. I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry.
Sure, no problem. Thanks again.
We will watch. Steve Goldstein writes for MarketWatch.com, and I hope to have you on again real soon, Steve.
Okay, take care.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN.